when you open this book, you stop dead in your tracks because you realize that you're hearing a voice that's come out of what has been an incredible void.
After 6 years of legal wrangling, the diary of a Guantanamo inmate is finally published. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. New Jersey Governor and likely presidential hopeful Chris Christie has been dubbed the YouTube Governor. But it's not for his bedside manner.
You think you're getting behind this microphone, having me talk about Twinkies? This is a setup, man. I know it. You people are the worst.
Also, when telemarketers sound like robots, maybe they really are.
I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
There's more coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In Tuesday's State of the Union address, President Obama said it was time to finish the job of closing the prison at Guantanamo Bay, exactly 6 years since he ordered it promptly closed.
And I will not relent in my determination to shut it down. It is not who we are. It's time to close Gitmo.
Of the almost 800 men once held there, 122 remain. One of them is Mahamadou Ould Salahi, whose book Guantanamo Diary was published the same day as the president's address. Salahi finished his manuscript in 2006, but it took a 6-year legal battle and the vigorous hands of censors before the government agreed to its release. Larry Seams was the editor of Guantanamo Diary. He's a writer and former director of the Penn American Center's Freedom to Write programs. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Let's begin why Mahamadou Salahi was even taken into custody. What did the government think he had been responsible for?
Well, it's not even really very clear. The United States had interrogated Mahamadou even before 9/11. He was briefly in Montreal. He arrived there shortly after a man named Ahmad Rassam left Montreal. Rassam was picked up on the eve of the millennium trying to drive a car into the United States packed with explosives as part of what was called the Millennium Bomb Plot. When he flew from Montreal to Dakar, Senegal, which is where his family was going to meet him and drive him back to Mauritania, he was detained by Senegalese security agents at the behest of the United States, questioned by the FBI about the Millennium Bomb Plot, and cleared.
Cleared because it turned out that he arrived in Montreal long after the perpetrators of the aborted plot had left town.
Exactly. So in November of 2001, Mahamadou gets another call from the Mauritanian security forces. They say the United States wants to ask more questions. He drives himself to the police station. He's put on that flight and sent to Amman, Jordan, where he's interrogated by the Jordanians for 8 months. The Jordanians again clear him of any involvement in the Millennium Plot. But instead of sending him home at that point, the CIA turn him over to the military, and he's held briefly in Bagram and then delivered to Guantanamo in August of 2002.
And at every step along the way, tortured.
He is. The book describes what I came to recognize as a kind of a modern-day odyssey. He covers 20,000 miles in an interrogation and detention route that includes detention facilities in Senegal, Mauritania, Amman, Jordan, Bagram, and ultimately Guantanamo.
Reviewers have variously compared Guantanamo Diary to the Salem witch trials and to The Trial by Franz Kafka and the experience of Joseph K. That definitely scans. Tell me about some of the things he heard while he was there from his interrogators.
They would come at him essentially saying, "We know what you've done, so tell us what you've done." And Mahamadou, of course, would say, "Well, I've done nothing." And they said, "No, come on." And they would turn up the pressure even more. So it gives a picture of this kind of deadlock in the interrogation room that covered a period of months, even years.
Because he was told if he hadn't done something, he wouldn't be there, which is as circular a piece of logic as ever you'll encounter. Here's an excerpt read for The Guardian newspaper by Peter Serafinowicz.
"You joined the wrong team, boy. You fought for a lost cause," he said, alongside a bunch of trash talk degrading my family, my religion, and myself, not to mention all kinds of threats against my family to pay for my crimes, which goes against any common sense. I knew that he had no power, but I knew that he was speaking on behalf of the most powerful country in the world and obviously enjoyed the full support of his government. However, I would rather save you, dear reader, from quoting his garbage.
One of the incredible things is how empathetic, in many ways, Mohamedou is with his interrogators and the position that they've been put in. And he thinks and talks very specifically about the dilemma of the interrogators. They don't know. They're just told that these are very, very bad guys. These are the worst of the worst. Now go get information out of them. So they, too, are kind of caught in this very Kafkaesque drama. And for the first time, I think one of the most vivid things about the book is it really presents the human toll of this experience on our servicemen and women and intelligence agents, something that we've never seen before in any of the documents or literature that's come out of Guantanamo.
It amazes me that Salahe was even permitted to write the book, to keep the pages. How were they not confiscated by his captors for use in their own intelligence gathering?
Well, I don't doubt that they were. In March of 2005, when they finally granted lawyers access to the prisoners in Guantanamo, he greeted them with a bunch of papers in which he sort of began to tell his story, and he started telling it for them. Very quickly, that changed to the book that was being told for us, for the American people. At this time in 2005, there's a conscious effort to rehabilitate him. I mean, we took him to the absolute brink at a moment that, incidentally, is corroborated by the documentary record. Is a moment where after, you know, extreme sleep deprivation and brutality, he begins to hallucinate that he's hearing voices, and he hears the voices of his family and sort of heavenly Quranic readings. So that's where he was in the fall of 2004. And then they start to bring in a fresh team of guards. He got pen and paper during that time, and I think it was part of a clear effort to help restore him physically and emotionally. What's amazing is that he manages to compose something that's, I mean, composed in every sense of the word, from a writerly sense to an emotional sense to a sense of perspective and real generosity and even forgiveness.
Until now, for the most part, Guantanamo detainees have been exotic people with unpronounceable names in orange jumpsuits, accused in one way or another of participation in terrorism, not the most sympathetic cohort, right? And now there's a human face, and a particularly eloquent one. What has been the reaction so far?
Well, it's been astonishing and really a hopeful thing to watch. I think what people are responding to is when you open this book, you stop dead in your tracks because you realize that you're hearing a voice that's come out of what has been an incredible void. The thing that you describe of the sense of the otherness of the prisoners— what's incredible is to watch the interrogators and the guards, many of whom come to that place with those feelings. And we all have misconceptions, and those misconceptions have been fueled by the secrecy. And when that secrecy is broken and you actually hear a human voice and you see how harrowingly intimate the human exchanges are that take place there, you have to stop and listen.
In a response to a habeas corpus filing, he was actually ordered released 5 years ago by a federal judge, but the government appealed the decision, and he's been in Guantanamo limbo ever since. So what is he still doing there?
Let's start with the fact that we shouldn't even be asking that question, right? He's been there for 12 years. He's been in U.S. detention for 13. We should be able to explain to ourselves why he's there, but we can't. The story of Guantanamo writ large is a story of secrecy. It was created to be a secret space so that mistreatment and torture could happen. Even when the torture stopped, secrecy began to serve the purpose of covering up those misdeeds and those crimes and delaying accountability for those crimes. I think to some extent, his story and the story of, you know, many other, we know now quite clearly, innocent men who are still in Guantanamo has been a story, appallingly, of simply prolonging the inevitable and along the way perpetuating terrible mistakes. And what this book does for the first time is it reframes the whole discussion about Guantanamo on a human level. And it reminds us that deferring dealing with terrible mistakes that we've made means endlessly prolonging the suffering of their families. And it means, and I think the book makes very clear, prolonging the burden that we put on our own servicemen and women who have been put in this position. And it's time that we assume that ourselves.
Larry, thank you very much.
Bob, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Larry Seams is the editor of Guantanamo Diary. On Tuesday, an ISIS video surfaced online with the all-too-familiar trappings, a bleak desert backdrop and captive men jumpsuited pointedly in Gitmo orange, kneeling next to a masked figure wielding a knife. For the first time, though, the hostages were Japanese citizens.
To the Japanese public, just as how your government has made the foolish decision to pay $200 million to fight the Islamic State, you now have 72 hours to pressure your government in making a wise decision by paying the $200 million to save the lives of your citizens.
The 72-hour countdown was set to expire on Friday afternoon Japan time. Several hours before the deadline, an ISIS spokesperson allegedly told a Japanese state news outlet that a statement was coming soon. Later, another video, not officially from ISIS, was released, showing a clock counting down to zero alongside images of previously beheaded hostages. But the deadline stipulated in the initial video has passed, and as of this writing on Friday afternoon, 1 Eastern Standard, the fate of the two Japanese captives remains unclear.
On Thursday afternoon, before the deadline had elapsed, I spoke with Roland Keltz, a writer who divides his time between Tokyo and New York. He says that the ISIS video was all over Japanese media almost instantaneously.
There is a great deal of anxiety in the media coverage. They don't want to be critical of anyone, whether it's the Japanese government or ISIS. They don't want to put these men at greater risk.
Tell me about these two captives. They've received very different reactions from the Japanese public, right?
Exactly. And their backgrounds are very different. Kenji Goto, who's the journalist, has been reporting from war zones since the 1990s. He commands a great deal of respect amongst journalists in Japan. People view him as someone who is doing a job and doing it very bravely, but not recklessly. Now, this other guy, Haruna Yukawa, he basically went off the rails.
He's been described as a private security contractor.
Yeah, sort of a self-styled soldier of fortune. His wife died of lung cancer in 2013. Thereafter, he lost his job and his home, and he took off for the Middle East, allegedly to learn about military operations, he said, so that he could help the Japanese military. He's being viewed with great suspicion overall by the Japanese public.
Now, back in October, apparently, Goto recorded a video on a cell phone.
He states in Japanese and in English that he takes full responsibility, that whatever happens to him, the people of Syria should not be blamed.
So it is my responsibility. If something happens, please don't have a bad impression to the Syrian people. Syrian people suffering 3 years and a half. It's enough.
And there's a backstory to this, which is that in 2004, 3 Japanese hostages were released in Iraq and sent home. They were treated harshly by the Japanese public and media.
These were aid workers,
and they were quite young, and they were seen as irresponsible, selfish. There's a term, okami, what we might call hubris. They actually went into hiding after they returned. A psychologist who was treating them said that the trauma of being abducted was actually less powerful than the trauma they experienced returning home and being shamed.
Why would the reaction be so harsh?
I think it's difficult perhaps for Americans to understand the cultural paradigm that most Japanese sustain, which is that Japan is not the police nation of the world. Japan has not been engaged in any kind of military activity that you would call warfare since the end of World War II. And a lot of Japanese are very proud of that record of pacifism, proud of the development of Japanese society economically, technologically. So for Japanese citizens who have everything provided for them by the society, by the culture, to run off into a military conflict in which Japan wants no part, and then for those individuals to ask for help from the Japanese government and people and financial support and putting other people's lives at risk is seen as intolerably selfish by many Japanese.
Well, let's consider another hostage situation. In 2005, Akihito Saito, a security guard working in Iraq, was killed after being taken hostage. But he was portrayed as a hero by most of Japanese media. So what's the difference between Saito and those aid workers?
I would say the difference is being official. I mean, in Japanese society, even today, having a business card that identifies you as a member of a company, you know, going up to the fifth floor every day and having a role to play is very, very important.
And the aid workers didn't have official standing?
Well, this goes into deeper cultural tropes, but there isn't a real history of volunteerism in Japan. Japan still, to some extent, has vestiges of its feudal past, whereby people lived in small villages and were expected to help one another. The idea of a stranger going into a situation and offering to volunteer is still quite alien. After the earthquake and tsunami in 2011, volunteers had a very difficult time, especially at the beginning, trying to help out Japanese who thought, why are these strangers coming here? What are they doing? So those kids, their position was very vague and seen as irresponsible. And I think in this particular situation, this is the difference between the way most Japanese view Goto, who is a professional journalist, they may have seen him on television reporting, and Yukawa, who is seen as somebody whose life fell apart, so he ran off to Syria, and now he's in trouble.
And this situation is coming at a complicated moment for Japan. The Prime Minister, Abe, is working to increase Japan's involvement with world affairs, and Abe's cabinet recently issued a decision to officially reinterpret the Constitution to allow Japan to engage in war if its allies are attacked, among other things.
It's very, very troubling. The video was released just a few days after Abe declared in Israel that Japan would offer exactly $200 million to support Syrian refugees. The Abe administration is pushing for this greater engagement with the rest of the world. And here, what happens? He makes the first big gesture, and a few days later, Japanese are watching their own threatened by a knife-wielding terrorist. Depending on how this plays out, the majority of Japanese may feel like Abe's push to rejigger the Constitution and Japan's presence is a disaster, that the country should cling to its pacifist ways and get out of war zones.
The novelist Murakami is in that camp, right?
Well, Haruki Murakami is what we would call a baby boomer. He was born in 1949. He grew up in a Japan that rapidly developed, that acquired economic status, acquired comfort, wealth. And for someone like Haruki Murakami and his generation, that all happened under the umbrella of pacifism. Why would a nation that has prospered and thrived, you know, 70-some years after the war, suddenly make a change? So there's a great deal of anxiety over what Abe was trying to do, and now, with this current situation, agony over what Japan should do going forward.
Are there any loud voices saying, we should just pay the ransom, we should just pay and be done with it?
I've asked a number of people in the Japanese media who've said it's just the opposite, that Japan should not pay, partly because a lot of Japanese feel like the country would be shamed if they caved in. In other words, it'd be viewed by the rest of the world as a shameful act.
Roland, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roland Keltz is a contributor to The New Yorker magazine. He's also a columnist for The Japan Daily, and he's the author of Japan America.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. At the beginning of this month, Republicans took the reins of Congress, prompting an outpouring of conventional wisdom from the pundits that the grand old party, after leading a House that broke records for doing nothing, now actually has to legislate to win in 2016.
First of all, Republicans have an opportunity, and they have to prove that they can govern.
I think the real onus is on Republicans to prove to the American people that they can govern.
It behooves Republicans to pass things, to pass legislation, and show the Americans that they can actually govern.
It sounds right that Republicans in Congress have to prove their governing abilities to win in 2016, but Talking Point Memo's Sahil Kapoor found that there's a wealth of data to suggest that's not actually the case.
American voters will blame the president when things are going badly and will credit the president when things are going well. So the perverse thing here is that 2 years of gridlock in Congress could actually help the Republicans by damaging the president's approval rating and by preventing the economy from improving further.
That's quite an assertion, though, that American voters will always blame the president. Where's your data?
There's plenty of it going back decades. The most recent one I've seen was a survey taken after the midterm election. It was a Quinnipiac poll, and it asked American voters, if there is gridlock for the next 2 years in Congress and big things don't happen, who would you blame, the Republicans who run it or the president? And by 44 to 42% margin, they said they'd blame the president. There was also a 1999 study by a political scientist named Helmut Norpoth that had a similar finding that voters hold the president's party accountable for outcomes, especially economic outcomes.
I've even read a study that has found that for at least the last 100 years, presidents have been held responsible at the polls, it seems, for floods and droughts.
Right. Even things that the president doesn't control at all. For instance, the Ebola scare that we had a few months ago, it impacted the president's poll numbers, even though it's very, very difficult to argue he had anything to do with it. So that kind of perfectly illustrates the point.
Did the president get credit for dropping oil prices, even though he had nothing to do with that either?
Absolutely. Look, right now we're seeing President Obama's approval rating go up a little bit, and people can attribute it to all sorts of things. I personally think it's because the economy is improving, and that includes oil prices falling and other things like the Ebola scare and the flood of unaccompanied children at the border. These things have subsided a little bit, so there's less of a sense that the country is adrift than there was a few months ago when the president's approval rating was in free fall.
But getting back to the main point, what about the tough Senate races for Republicans in 2016? There are six incumbents that face re-election in states that Obama won twice. Don't the Republicans there need to work with Democrats at least on some issues? And won't that ensure slightly less gridlock in the Congress?
Well, yes and no. So that is a really interesting wrinkle, Brooke. Firstly, Republicans have a very tough Senate map in 2016. I believe the numbers are 24 Republicans are up for re-election and only 10 Democrats are up for re-election. And six of those Republicans, as you said, are in states that President Obama won twice. Another one of them is in a state that President Obama won once in 2008. So what these Republicans will have to do is create some distance from their party and show that they're not dyed-in-the-wool Ted Cruz, Rand Paul partisans, that they're going to step across the aisle. But that doesn't necessarily mean things are going to get done. There are many ways this could play out. It's possible that these Senate Republicans side with Democrats on certain issues like perhaps the minimum wage or equal pay legislation or something that would send a signal to swing voters, moderate voters, that they're not extremely conservative, but at the same time, even if the Senate passes those bills, the House can kill them. So that doesn't necessarily amount to governing. That could be a strategic decision by these senators and perhaps even the Senate Republican leadership to let these senators off the hook, work with Democrats on certain things, knowing that it won't actually get signed into law or even pass the House anyway.
Okay, so the data show that if nothing happens in Congress, the president will still be blamed, and that'll be good for the Republicans in 2016. Nevertheless, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told the Washington Post just before Christmas that the party needed to be not scary. Quote, "I want the American people to be comfortable with the fact that the Republican House and Senate is a responsible right-of-center governing majority." So even if it benefits the Republicans to continue the gridlock this year, if the Senate majority leader nevertheless believes the conventional wisdom that it will hurt them, doesn't that mean he'll try and get stuff done?
I would question that premise a little bit, Brooke. I'm not necessarily sure he believes this because Mitch McConnell, I believe, understands the game better than anyone else. He understands how politics is played and he understands how to shape events to his desired outcome. What he's been doing is he's been striking all the right notes. He's been saying we want to be cooperative. He's been saying we want to be productive, governing partner and all that stuff. This is what everyone says when they get elected. It remains to be seen how much of this will actually happen.
This is the same Mitch McConnell who said that he wanted to ensure that Obama would be a one-term president.
Exactly. He pioneered some very innovative ways of grinding the Senate to a halt, record filibusters and party discipline. Mitch McConnell understands the value of obstruction when there is a president of the opposite party. So it remains to be seen how he'll handle it. He has a bit of a tougher needle to thread, as we discussed, partly because of his members who are up for re-election, and also partly because when you're running the place, you have to make people believe that you're at least trying.
I just wonder, who is determining conventional wisdom now? Rush Limbaugh says that it used to be David Gergen, the bipartisan political veteran who is on every talk show.
Whatever David Rodham Gergen said, you could count on that being the conventional wisdom. That torch is being passed. John Heilemann and Mark Halperin are quickly becoming the new arbiters of conventional wisdom in Washington.
John Heilemann and Mark Halperin, who are hosts of the Bloomberg News Politics show, with all due respect, in this cacophonous media environment, do we really have a conventional wisdom anymore?
So, you know, I take your point, Brooke, about there's no one person or no two or three people necessarily who set the conventional wisdom. But sometimes a certain idea or a certain narrative takes hold and a lot of people believe it. And in this case, the idea about Republicans and their having to govern in Congress, that seems to be very, very widely accepted.
What do you think the impact is of constantly repeating something as conventional wisdom that may not reflect reality?
I think our analysis matters less than we believe. When lawmakers, when politicians make decisions, it's based on certain assumptions about voters not necessarily paying attention to the conventional wisdom. And they don't, because they have no reason to. They have better things to do than follow every twist and turn in every political debate.
So the punditocracy may be telling the American voter that Republicans in Congress need to be more willing to compromise to position themselves favorably for the presidency in 2016, but the politicians themselves know better.
That's right.
Okay, Sahil, thank you very much.
Happy to be on, Brooke.
Sahil Kapoor is Talking Point Memo's senior congressional reporter and a Supreme Court correspondent. This week marked the fifth anniversary of every liberal's least favorite Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, that opened the floodgates of politics to almost unlimited dark money. The ruling notoriously found that corporations are endowed with the same constitutional rights as people, or as Mitt Romney put it during his presidential run.
Corporations are people, my friend. Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people.
Mitt's remark seemed gift wrap for liberal derision, here expressed by Senator Elizabeth Warren.
No, Governor Romney, corporations are not people. People have hearts. They have kids.
Kent Greenfield is a professor of corporate and constitutional law at Boston College and a critic of Citizens United. But in a recent article for the Washington Monthly, he says our problem is not that we have too much corporate personhood, but what, Kent?
Too little. My take on this is that corporate personhood is one of the most important legal innovations in the development of our national wealth. And here's why. Corporations are separate in order to facilitate investment. So when I invest in General Motors, I'm insulated from the liability of that company. So if cars roll over, I'm not liable for that as an investor. The same goes for employees and indeed managers if they're not personally responsible for what happened. So that separateness protects investors. One would never invest in General Motors or Chevron or BP if you thought you might have personal liability for their mistakes.
Yeah, but wouldn't it make those companies more accountable?
Sometimes harms that are caused by corporations are so great that they can only be paid out of the corporate pocket. And, you know, think about the BP oil spill. No individual has enough money to pay for those damages. So it's important for corporations to have separate legal personhood in order to make sure that there's some entity out there who can be held responsible for bad behavior.
So personhood can also be a mechanism for enforcing accountability.
Absolutely. To be a legal person means that not only do you have legal standing to sue, you also have a legal standing to be sued. When it comes to First Amendment free speech matters, I think there are situations in which corporations should be protected in saying things that are germane to their business and are important in the public debate. But I don't think that corporations should have the same free speech rights that you and I do, because once they get far afield from their business, then it becomes much less relevant to the public debate, and it's much more likely to be a matter of self-dealing or misappropriation of corporate resources internally.
Let's apply all of this to another notorious recent case. Last summer, the Supreme Court ruled that the corporation Hobby Lobby was legally exempt from the mandate to provide contraceptives in its health care on religious grounds. This was seen by many as a victory for corporate personhood. But you, along with a group of corporate lawyers, filed a brief against Hobby Lobby, arguing on the grounds of corporate personhood. Please try and comb this out.
So the case came about when the family that owns Hobby Lobby, this evangelical family, claimed that when the government required Hobby Lobby, the company, to provide contraceptives to their employees, it was a violation of the family's religious rights. What we argued was that corporate personhood should have led the court to say that the family's religious rights were not at issue because of that idea of separateness. The family that owns Hobby Lobby incorporated Hobby Lobby in order to protect them from legal liability, in order to separate the family from the business of the company. Our argument was that they should not be able to separate themselves from the company for purposes of liability, but say that they're one and the same for purposes of religious rights. So corporate personhood should have led the court to say, look, Hobby Lobby is one thing, the shareholders are the other, and the shareholders' religious beliefs don't really affect the company one way or the other.
But if the courts don't apply this concept completely, then it's dangerous to have it at all.
Well, the idea of corporate separateness and corporate personality is everywhere in corporate law and, in fact, is a basis of corporate law. And I think the fact that the Supreme Court did not get it right in this one case doesn't doom this endeavor forever. I just think they got it wrong.
Let's go back to the case at hand, spending on political campaigns. A recent report from the Brennan Center found that outside political spending more than doubled since the Citizens United ruling in 2010. Now the conventional liberal wisdom is that this influx of dark money stems from the recognition of corporations as people. You say that's just not true.
It's not true in this respect. The largest corporate donor in the 2012 election cycle was Chevron. They gave $2.5 million. But Sheldon Adelson and his wife gave over $90 million. The Koch brothers gave over $400 million. So the problem of money in politics is a serious problem, but it's a problem mostly of rich individuals, not corporations. So I don't want to minimize the risk of corporate money in politics, but at the same time, I think the focus on corporate personhood leads us to ignore what I think is the larger problem of rich individuals getting involved. And also, I think our thinking and our debate about remedies really is affected by where we think the problems are. I mean, I think the problem is money, full stop, not corporate money. So I think the remedies need to be aimed at the regulation of corporate finance in general.
Why do you think people like Senator Elizabeth Warren and President Obama, both of them former law professors, Obama a constitutional law professor, why have they campaigned unabashedly on an anti-corporate personhood platform? Do they not get it?
I think it's the nature of politics, right? You want to have a slogan that cuts to the heart of the matter. And in some ways, they're right that this engages the Democratic base in ways that other slogans have not. Because people fear, and rightly so in my view, the power of corporations, not only in politics but in other areas of our lives. My only response is that arguing that corporations are not people is like tearing down a house to get rid of termites. the energy for change is a finite resource. And I think that energy could be much better spent at focusing on limiting corporate power in other ways.
Kent, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Kent Greenfield is a law professor at Boston College. His article for The Washington Monthly is called "Let Us Now Praise Corporate Persons."
Any day now, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is expected to formally announce he's exploring a presidential run. In 5 years, he's gone from being a relatively unknown U.S. attorney to being a national household name. And he did it by running a nimble media operation that capitalized on his charm, temper, and ability to step past or on the reporters who cover him, like Matt Katz of New Jersey Public Radio.
This movie trailer was prepared inside the New Jersey State House.
This summer, from the makers of...
Together, we've begun to clean up the mess of the past.
The trailer was emailed to thousands of reporters and TV producers around the country.
How far would you go?
There is no other way to fix a severe problem like this but with pain.
It was posted on Twitter and hashtagged No Pain, No Gain. And as much as it sounded like a movie trailer,
hang on to your seats.
This was actually a video teasing Governor Christie's town hall meetings on pension reform.
Pensions, health benefits, and debt service.
This is how you build a politician's brand. Chris Christie is the first YouTube governor. His communications team releases almost daily videos of him joking around and yelling at reporters, talking passionately about his mother, or wagging his finger at liberals. Much of his celebrity can be traced back to a town hall meeting in 2010 when he took on an elementary school teacher.
Well, listen, let's start with this. I stood here and very respectfully listened to you. If what you want to do is put on a show and giggle every time I talk, well, then I have no interest in answering your question.
The video got more than 1 million YouTube views. A social media unit was created in the governor's office. They now shoot, direct, and cut tape from every speech, press conference, and late-night TV interview. The videos accentuate the parts of his personality that have captured the American political imagination, like the time he deflected a question about the closure of a factory owned by Hostess, which makes Twinkies.
You think you're getting behind this microphone? Having me talk about Twinkies? This is a setup, man. I know it. You people are the worst.
To mark his 5 millionth view on YouTube, his team packaged highlights of his sound bites into a best of video.
The one thing you won't be able to say at the end of this 4 years is that you didn't know me.
I got sent here to do a job. I get sent here to be elected prom king.
Get me out of the cage and let me go.
I have something better to do. I have to rearrange my sock drawer tonight.
But it's not just the entertaining videos. It's also their distribution. The list of reporters who received Christie's videos was a state secret for 4.5 years. WNYC finally sued after several open public records requests were denied. As part of the settlement agreement, I was able to view the list in the governor's office of communications. What I saw was email addresses for about 2,500 journalists and TV producers who get these YouTube links in their inboxes before reporters like me can even file our stories. It shows how Christie runs his own news operation, producing clips ready-made for cable TV news, like Morning Joe on MSNBC.
How many times can we tell Chris Christie we love him?
I think we should watch him.
He is so Jersey.
I think we should watch him.
In every great way.
No single person has been more involved in shaping Christie's brand than Maria Camella. Associates say the deputy chief of staff for communications has become the most important governmental aide to Christie. She sits directly across from his office. She's rarely in front of the cameras, but she made an appearance on the governor's second most watched YouTube video, a spoof on Christie competing with then Newark Mayor Cory Booker. In the spoof, she mocks Christie's own YouTube-centric media operation.
You know, seriously, I think we're tapped out. I mean, there's only so many frickin' web videos we can do.
Camella has doubled the communication staff. It's about twice that of Christie's predecessor. She gives her staff goals on increasing Christie's Twitter followers and Facebook likes. Last week, the office put out a press release with stats on their social media success. That irked Democrats in the legislature, like Senator Loretta Weinberg.
Ahead of unemployment in the state are the numbers of views that he's gotten on YouTube, the numbers of likes he's gotten on his Facebook, and the number of tweets he's sent out to X number of followers.
Weinberg says it's amusing that the governor sees his social media numbers as an achievement when there are so many pressing issues facing the state.
Those are buried among a list of about our educational system, our unemployment rate, and the various other problems we have to face in New Jersey.
Now Christie is taking the brand national. One signal of that was last week when he held an hour-long, off-the-record session with national reporters before his State of the State speech. Statehouse reporters who cover Christie weren't allowed in. A national reporter told me that the access was an incentive to come to Trenton and cover the actual speech. It appeared to work. Here's Dana Bash from CNN.
I just want to stop for a second and talk about how incredibly different this is. I mean, here we are standing right on the floor of the General Assembly. You can't do this in Washington.
His team often leaks news to national publications before alerting the local press. That's because national reporters want scoops. So the best way to get them to cover something is to offer exclusives. For example, the New York Times was told in advance that Christie planned an official trip to Mexico, yielding a front-page piece about how he's reaching out to Latino voters. And when Christie made a visit to a football game at Camden High School, he didn't put the stop on his public schedule, which would have alerted the rest of the press corps. Instead, he gave a political reporter from the Washington Post exclusive access. The resulting article helped to build the brand Christie was pushing, of an unconventional Republican reaching out to minorities in the inner city.
I'm a little nervous tonight, but you guys came through. You played hard. Way to go. Good win.
His social media team was there, too. Heartwarming clips of Christie surrounded by Camden football players were then spliced together with a speech he had given about unity.
The ways we divide each other, by race, by class, by ethnicity, by wealth, and yes, by political party, is neither permanent nor necessary.
It looks and sounds like the next stage of the Christie brand is about to launch. Presidential candidate.
We have to be willing to play outside the red and blue boxes that the media pundits put us in.
Matt Katz has a new weekly podcast. It's called The Christie Tracker, and it's available at WNYC.org, or you can subscribe to it on iTunes.
This is On the Media.
Hey, it's Meredith from TLDR. This week we're bringing you a classic episode. Laura Mayer on something of particular interest to her, online sweepstakes and the people who win them.
I start with the instant sweepstakes. This Chef Boyardee daily instant win, they're giving away 5 Xboxes every day.
If you like that episode, there are 42 others equally as good. So download them all. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out the blog at tldr.onthemedia.org. Thanks.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After 4 years at WNYC, producer Chris Neary has moved on to something new. But we didn't want him to leave without a little fanfare. During his time here, not only did Chris help produce the show, he also amassed a pretty impressive list of pieces that he reported himself. There's the piece about the little TV channel hosted and produced for and by people with autism, a profile of the little guy losing a legal battle against the RIAA, who was suing him for $675,000.
There's the profile of the guy who wasn't the mastermind behind Bitcoin, but could have been. A story about the little school newspaper that stood up to bullies and refused to use the name of their own football team, the Redskins. And of course, his moving obit for the New Jersey magician, Bruce Bray. The common thread that drew most of Chris's pieces together is that they are about relatively unknown people committed to what they do. Like him. Of course, his favorite piece doesn't fit that mold at all. Oh, Chris.
Time Magazine Washington Bureau Chief Michael Scherer was closing that week's issue of the magazine when he got a call on his cell phone.
It's really a delightful voice. Incredibly engaging, friendly, slightly flirty.
Hello, how are you today? I'm calling about an online request you once made about health insurance coverage.
I have health insurance that I'm quite happy with. And I started talking back to her just sort of as a prank, and I realized that her responses were pretty canned. And so I said, you're a computer, right? And she had a very charming laugh.
I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
Through the afternoon, Samantha West kept calling, and Cher became more and more suspicious.
I looked at my cell phone and realized that I could call her whenever I wanted, and she would answer the phone as if she was calling me. And so I told the other people in my bureau that we should find out what's going on.
One of those people was Zeke Miller. He covers the White House for Time.
Michael walked down the hall to my office and said, dial this number.
Hello, how are you today? Well, I'm calling about an online request you once made about health insurance.
Intrigued by Samantha's dubious humanity, Zeke and another Time reporter, Denver Nix, pressed the issue, repeatedly calling her back using the number on Cher's cell phone.
We work with all major companies and compare all the rates for you.
Oh, cool.
I can get you a quote in about 5 minutes. Yes.
What's your name?
Okay, Samantha West.
Miller and Nix called Samantha West about 10 times. When they began by asking, are you a robot? She'd politely hang up. So they learned to humor her by answering a few of her healthcare questions, building slowly to the only question that matters when you suspect the person you're talking with is a robot.
You really do sound like a robot.
I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
Are you sure?
Yes.
At some point, Nix discarded the politeness you'd afford another human being.
It would just make me feel so much better to hear you say, I am not a robot.
What? Let me ask you a couple of questions. Are you currently on Medicare?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
But now let me ask you a question.
Medicaid or looking for Medicaid?
We'll go, you ask me a question, then I'll ask you a question. How about that?
Sure.
Okay, are you a robot?
No.
If you search Samantha West on the internet, you'll see not every telemarketing target is so skeptical. You see comments like,
I always hang up on her because she calls and identifies herself and then says nothing. I don't know what she wants, but I'm blocking her
Samantha
number.
West keeps calling me from 412-430-5588, even though I keep telling her to stop calling me.
Samantha West is not unique.
My name is Amanda Thomas, and I'm going with Corporations for Character on behalf of
Corporations.
I'm so sorry. I'm having a hard time hearing anything you're saying. I'll have a manager call back from a better phone shortly.
No.
The Tampa Bay Times and the Center for Investigative Journalism looked at charities that use these kinds of calls. That's where these recordings are from.
What color is the sky?
Well, I thank you so much for your time today. Maybe you can help
out
on the next drive. Take care and have a good day, okay?
You're not a real person.
Bye-bye.
People who are fooled by Samantha West and her ilk don't record their calls, and some of them probably buy insurance. But listening to that kind of tape, it's impossible to conclude she's a real person, which means she's a robot.
Samantha West is not a robot. If we wanted to give Samantha West a catchy title, I would say Samantha West is a cyborg.
The Atlantic's Alexis Madrigal has written at length about the Samantha West of the world. A brief note for non-sci-fi fans. A cyborg is a human who has their mind or body augmented by technological devices.
What Samantha West is a person sitting either in Utah or the Philippines, my guess is the Philippines, pressing buttons on a computer that play pre-recorded audio to a call receiver.
So when a telemarketing target picks up a call from Samantha West, they hear her energetic, perky voice. But there's a human operator controlling what that voice says by clicking on the right button.
They can hit, for example, L to laugh, and they can just keep hitting the L to do that. So it's like. But the idea is that the operator gets really good at using these little conversational asides in order to like make the conversation feel natural. So another example, you hit the equal sign and say, exactly. Hit the equal sign. Exactly.
While cyborg Samantha West may be unsettling to contemplate, Madrigal says he found versions of Samantha West that were, if not honest, at least more honest. And some of the companies who sell Samantha-like systems claim it can prevent fraud.
And the reason is, when you have a bunch of call center workers where the turnover is like 400%, multiple times the turnover at a fast food restaurant, you've got people whose incentives do not necessarily align with always saying exactly the right thing. I mean, these are people who are living pretty close to the edge of survival, making ends meet. And you've got their managers relentlessly flogging them, trying to get them to make more sales. And so what you have is people sometimes say, don't read all the disclosures that they're supposed to read because they know it'll take too much time and they might lose the sale. And so the big pitch, actually, for a lot, particularly the American-based companies that sell this technology, is that every single thing will be said exactly as the script wanted it said.
But nobody likes being lied to. And in fact, the operator behind us, Samantha West, is free to jump into the conversation at any time and initiate a human-to-human interaction. So there's nothing stopping a righteous operator from making an honest woman of Samantha West.
Can that overcome the kind of original sin that you're not talking to another human's voice? I don't know. If Tommy in Utah is placing the call, is listening to the call, is responding to you live, like, are you talking to a human?
We already have automated tutors, diagnosticians, and bureaucrats. But we know they're machines. What if cyborg salespeople like Samantha did come clean? Here's one of the Time reporters, Denver Nix.
You know, what would I have done if she had said, yeah, I'm a robot? Anyway, as we were saying, I don't know what I would have said. That's really, that's heavy, man. I guess, you know, she was trying to enroll me in health insurance, and I would have just said, like, oh, you know, thanks for answering my question. I'm sorry I was being such a jerk. I have health insurance. Have a nice day.
So Samantha West could actually help. Telemarketing is often a scam. What if honesty could be automated? For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sarah Durkman, Laura Mayer, Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, and Kasia Mihailovich. We also had more help from Jesse Brenneman, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Merritt Jacob.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.